Welcome to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich. The term shaken baby syndrome conjures up images of an angry, frustrated parent or caregiver simply losing it and shaking a child so violently that it causes brain damage, sometimes even death. But what if the explanation is not that clear-cut? And what if it's not abuse at all? A recent Ohio case illustrates the complexities in diagnosing, investigating, and litigating such cases. ProPublica reporter Pamela Koloff recently wrote about the issue in her story, which was co-published with ProPublica and the New York Times Magazine. The article's title is, "He Frantically Called 911 to Revive His Infant Son, and Now He Could Face 12 Years in Prison." Welcome to All Sides, Pamela.
Thank you so much for having me.
So how did you learn about the case of Nick and Felicia Flannery of Blue Ash, Ohio, and the medical emergency that their son had?
Yes, I've been looking into this issue for quite a while and had interviewed a number of families, but it was Nick and Felicia's story that really struck me like no other. It began, I think any of us can imagine ourselves in a situation like this. This is a young couple living in the suburbs of Cincinnati, and Nick was taking care of their two-month-old baby, who I'll call Arlo. That's a nickname that his parents asked that I use to protect his privacy. But he was taking care of Arlo on his own, and the baby vomited while he was being given a bottle, and then a few minutes later had seizure-like symptoms and lost consciousness. And Nick called 911 and sought emergency care for him immediately.
And then this leads the couple on a medical odyssey. And it also jumpstarts a police investigation into the dad. So what was the first inkling that there was some serious trouble here?
So paramedics were able to revive Arlo, but he was taken to the local ER. And CT scans revealed the presence of what are called subdural hematomas. That's bleeding between the brain and the skull. So the Flannerys were taken aside, and a social worker told them this was a symptom that could be seen in abuse cases, and that because of mandatory reporting laws, that police and child welfare advocates had to be alerted, but that they would be doing further testing to try to understand what was going on. I think this is a really, really important part of this case, and I've seen it in other cases I've looked at. The baby had no external signs of abuse, so no bruises, no scratches, no cuts, no external head trauma like a scalp injury, no broken bones, no symptoms of neglect or malnutrition. And his parents were sole caregivers. Neither of them had had any previous interaction with Child Protective Services or a criminal history. So what you're thinking of when you see, you know, a baby coming into the ER and doctors are alarmed, that's not what this looked like.
Now, I do want to add, just for our listeners, Arlo, their son, made a full recovery. So we should yes. definitely add that. But the case was not over. So Nick faces a trial later this year. What did the Flannerys and their medical experts say happened to Arlo? Because, I mean, they deny abuse and had no previous record of yes. abuse. And so what do they say happened?
Yes, they were, they were very shocked by this suggestion that there had been abuse and deny of harming their child. But there was a child abuse team at the hospital, and those doctors came in and raised what was called a concern for abusive head trauma, which is a newer term for shaken baby syndrome. And that concern, it wasn't even an official diagnosis, then just triggered this cascade of events. So suddenly, Child Protective Services, JFS became involved. The children were taken and put in a relative's home. The Flannerys, went through quite an odyssey getting the children back into their home. They agreed to have cameras installed in every room so that they could be monitored at all times. They were only allowed to have their children back in their home with the presence of approved family members. But Nick was ultimately arrested on charges of abuse last January. The kids were taken away again temporarily. It's just they're back right now under these very stringent rules, but it's been a very, very difficult situation. Though there is all sorts of alternate explanations for what happened to Arlo.
So two members of the child abuse team at Cincinnati Children's Hospital came to different conclusions than what the Flannery's medical experts, because the Flannery's had to hi they hired their own medical expert and a lawyer for their side of the story. We invited members of the Cincinnati Children's Hospital team to be on the show, but the university's media relations team declined the invitation. But what did, when the Flannery's hired a lawyer and then hired some medical experts, what did they say was the reason that Arlo had the had this happen?
So there were a lot of different concerning things that had been going on with Arlo. He had an extremely traumatic birth that ended in an emergency C-section. There's a photo that ran with my story that anyone can see on the ProPublica or New York Times Magazine website of the trauma that he had immediately after birth to his head. It's a quite a startling picture of a hollow above his forehead. And so the doctors that they consulted came to the conclusion because of that and another really important bit of evidence, which is that the child's head circumference had been rapidly expanding for quite a while, that this was an ongoing health condition that stemmed from birth trauma. This was also bolstered actually by a doctor at Cincinnati Children's, a neurosurgeon, who operated on Arlo to relieve the pressure that was going on and on his brain. And he diagnosed those subdural hematomas as chronic, meaning they had been there for a while, not acute, not something sudden like abuse. But what I saw through this investigation and many, many other cases that I looked at is though child abuse pediatricians say that they do a really rigorous workup. They consider all of other possibilities that could cause these same symptoms. What you see again and again is that this concern for possible abusive head trauma, rather than it being the beginning of an investigation, often things sort of stop there and like I said, Child Protective Services and police come into play.
So the people who said that it was abuse and said that the father should be arrested, they disagree with the medical experts that the Flannery family right? So they read
They
the
do.
head trauma a different way. It's just two ways of
They
looking at the
do.
same thing.
Yes. That said, I think that things that the neurosurgeon saw, such as, I won't get too far into the weeds here, but things like straw-colored fluid on his head is something that is universally understood to be indicative of a chronic injury, not an acute one. So what I saw in looking at these cases, there are now, as of today, there are 40 people whose convictions rested on the diagnosis who are currently listed on the National Registry of Exonerations. Last year, a New Jersey appellate court backed a lower court judge who pronounced the diagnosis, quote, akin to junk science. There are a lot of questions about this diagnosis, and I think that combined with the fact that you can have the word of one child abuse pediatrician overruling a myriad of other types of specialists is a real cause for concern.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about shaken baby syndrome, which is now called abusive head trauma, with ProPublica reporter Pamela Koloff. Tell me about that change. Why did the name change from shaken baby syndrome to abusive head trauma?
In 2009, the American Academy of Pediatrics recommended that pediatricians stop using the term shaken baby syndrome and that they start using a more comprehensive term, abusive head trauma. And that describes not only injuries that result from shaking, but also those resulting from blunt impact or a combination of the two. What I found so interesting was that that name change came at a moment when shaken baby syndrome was coming under a tremendous scrutiny. There was a lot of controversy surrounding it in the courts. What had been shown is that its signature symptoms, brain swelling, bleeding around the brain, and from the retina, were not always evidence of abuse. Various cases had shown that these symptoms could also be caused by things like accidental falls, illness, infection, congenital disorders, and so forth. So this name change came about at a time when there were all these questions being asked about the diagnosis. And what I posit in my story is that through this name change and a slight definitional change, people aren't aware that shaken baby syndrome as a diagnosis is still very much with us in the present day, and that it's shaping police investigations and child welfare investigations across the country.
Now, sometimes it is abuse. Sometimes a parent or
Absolutely.
caregiver does, the baby won't stop crying and they get abusive. I'm sure you came across those cases as well.
Absolutely. And let me be very, very, very clear here. Child abuse is very real. The work that the pediatricians do in trying to suss out what has happened and that police and social workers do is absolutely vital to children. And I think the issue becomes how do we separate those very real and terrible cases of abuse from some of these other cases where separating children from their parents causes tremendous trauma in and of itself.
So you highlighted this one case in particular, but you looked at many others, and you mentioned these exonerations and how people are found. So do you feel like there's been several cases where people are convicted of a child abuse and or the death of a child, saying that they shook the baby, but then it ended up being not true?
Exactly. So here in Texas, where I'm based, there was a story that made national headlines last fall. There's a man on death row here named Robert Robertson. His case is quite similar to some of the cases I've spoken about. And a review of the evidence by a bipartisan group of lawmakers ended up so troubling those lawmakers that they worked to halt his scheduled execution last fall and are now calling for a wholesale reappraisal of the evidence. And there are people in prison all over the country on these charges. As you pointed out, there are very real cases of abuse. But when we go back and look at some of these other cases, there are many, many questions, and there are people serving incredibly long sentences. I wrote another story last year about a Tennessee father whose case is almost identical to Nick Flannery's, except the child died in that case. He's been in prison since 1999. There are seven medical witnesses that have testified in open court that they have looked at all of the evidence and the records and believe this is not a case of abuse. The Nashville district attorney has said that he's innocent, but the judge presiding over the case will not grant a new trial. So people are trapped in this system once a conviction is in place.
Now, the Flannery's case from here in Ohio, from Blue Ash, Ohio, that you featured in this story. What happens next in that case?
So what happens next? There's sort of two tracks. There's the child welfare track and then the criminal track. Nick is currently facing a possibility of up to 12 years in prison. There will be a trial date set at some point this year, and both sides will have to sort of fight out the evidence that we just discussed. On the child welfare front, it is the stated intention of JFS to take these children from the family, and it seems that they're waiting to see what the resolution is in criminal court. But if you can just imagine the strain on a family after this much time, close to a year and a half of being under the microscope of every moment, having cameras in every room of their home to show that they're good parents. Even if everything works out in this case, and there's absolutely no guarantee of that, there's been a tremendous toll on the children and the parents.
And I mean, and Arlo's okay. So whatever did happen to
He
his head,
is.
whatever happened to his head, he's recovered.
He is. So that intracranial pressure that was building for weeks, perhaps months, was relieved by an operation that was performed. And ever since then, he's been fine. He's been meeting and exceeding all his milestones. I got to meet him. He's a happy little guy. And the Flannerys have done a lot to create as normal of a home environment as they can with all of this going on. They've had to have extended family members move in with them to fulfill the court's order about always having someone there present with them.
And so now we just have to see whenever it goes to criminal trial, and the Flannerys will have their experts, and then there'll be the experts on the other side and the ones who saw him in the hospital, and it's basically see who the judge or jury, I don't know if it's a jury trial, will decide is right.
Exactly. And so many of these cases become sort of a battle of the experts. And it really depends, what your quality, if you're a defendant, what your quality of your representation is, who your lawyer is, if they have any experience with these cases before. I think something important too, when we talked about those exoneration numbers, 40 may not sound like a lot of people. But we have to understand that exonerations are the tip of the iceberg. So, just a quick explanation, roughly 95% of criminal cases are handled, they're disposed of with plea deals. They never go to trial. And we never n know what happens in these cases. So, for a case to have made it to trial, to have successfully, it's so hard once a conviction is in place to overturn it. What we know from that number of 40 is that there are many, many, many other cases like this out there.
Thanks to ProPublica reporter Pamela Koloff, who recently wrote about the complexities in diagnosing, investigating, and litigating cases of abusive head trauma in babies. Thanks for joining us, Pamela.
Thank you so much.
Coming up, we're going to talk with a child abuse pediatrician with the American Academy of Pediatrics. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
We could all use a little help navigating the news these days. The Consider This podcast wants to give you a hand. 6 days a week, we'll help you make sense of the day's biggest news story and what it means for you in less than 15 minutes. Listen now to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. We're talking this hour about shaken baby syndrome, which is now known as abusive head trauma, and how advances in medical science are causing experts to rethink how it is diagnosed, treated, and litigated. Joining us now is Dr. Suzanne Haney, a child abuse pediatrician in Omaha and a member of the American Academy of Pediatrics. Welcome to All Sides.
Thank you very much.
So you were aware of the ProPublica reporting in the case of Nick Flannery from Ohio, but you weren't involved in that case, correct?
That is correct.
So our intent here is not to litigate that case, but to learn more about the work of a child abuse pediatrician and how medical science is evolving. So from your standpoint, can you tell me, what is it used to be known as shaken baby syndrome? Now it's abusive head trauma. What is that and how do you diagnose it?
So abusive head trauma is just a better term for this condition where an adult, usually a caregiver, harms a child. And it's, subjects the head to impact and or shaking to the point where the child is left with sometimes permanent injuries, and sometimes they don't survive. So that's kind of the condition. As a child abuse pediatrician, we're usually called in cases of suspected abuse or neglect, and we're usually called by other medical providers. So I function in the same way as a pediatric neurologist or a pediatric cardiologist. When the child's condition is a little bit more severe than that team is comfortable taking care of, they will call me in. As with other child abuse pediatricians, we usually make a diagnosis the same way any other doctor makes a diagnosis. We generate a list of possible other causes, called a differential diagnosis. And then from there, we will do testing or we will whittle it down and come to then finally a conclusion of what the diagnosis is. And in some cases, that diagnosis is abusive head trauma.
Now, when you say you're called in, are you called in by another doctor or does the police sometimes call you in?
So for the most part, I get called in by other physicians. Those are the cases that I see the children in person. Many of us will also take cases from attorneys and sometimes from law enforcement, depending on where the case in the jurisdiction. There's only about 250 of us to 300 of us throughout the country. So there are many areas which do not have child abuse pediatricians. And as such, we will lend our expertise to those entities to help ensure that the diagnosis is correct.
In the Nick Flannery case here in Ohio, and there are others, the diagnosis of abusive head trauma completely upends their lives before the case goes to trial. So as a doctor, I mean, you have to have that knowledge that you're making a significant diagnosis. You're going to upend someone's life. How does that inform what you do in your role?
So I'm quite aware that, you know, the diagnosis I make, whether it is on one hand saying that a child has been abused and therefore possibly taking them out of their home or then leading to somebody becoming arrested and or prosecuted, or on the other hand, not making a diagnosis when a child has been abused and then allowing them to go back into a home and possibly suffering further injury. So it's a weight that I understand, and I definitely will be very diligent and very thoughtful about the diagnosis I make. And there are times when either I will come in and say, no, this is not abuse. Mm-hmm. I might have another physician that says, oh, this is strange. It can't be anything else. And I'll say, no, this is my training. I do understand that this is a medical condition or this is an accident. There are times when I will just say, I don't know. I don't know if there's a medical condition, but I also doesn't really look like abuse either. So I'm not going to make that call.
And there's a range of things you can look for: brain swelling, bleeding around the brain. Is that always evidence of abuse, though, whenever you see it especially in a small baby?
No, it's a result of the trauma that happens to the head. And so therefore, trauma is probably the most common thing that we see as a possible other diagnosis for abuse, especially when we're talking abusive head trauma. So as the head is injured or impacted, it then leads to bleeding around the brain. It then leads to brain swelling, and then we may see other injuries too. So obviously there are other things that can cause that, and we certainly consider that when we make a diagnosis.
And do you also consider other signs of abuse? Because, you know, someone who's not a doctor might think there should be signs of malnutrition or neglect. There's other things that you can look for.
We look for them, definitely. So many of us have a process that we go through when we consider abuse, the testing that we do. And part of that really is looking for other injuries, which could be seen along with abusive head trauma. Every child who comes in gets a height and weight. So we certainly look at growth and development. And so that's just part of the general overview.
This is All Sides, and we're talking about the diagnosis of abusive head trauma, which used to be known as shaken baby syndrome, with Dr. Suzanne Haney. She is a child abuse pediatrician in Omaha and a member of the American Academy of Pediatrics. So there's a national registry of exonerations that lists 40 exonerations that were exonerations where there was a where there was a conviction diagnosis of shaken baby syndrome or abusive head trauma. One of the examples is Kim Hoover in Columbus. She was a child care provider in 2003. She was convicted of murder in the death of a 7-month-old girl in her care. Back then, it was called shaken baby syndrome. She spent 19 years in prison, but she was released last year. She was exonerated after medical records and experts determined the baby's head injuries were old. So here in the Wrongful Conviction podcast last year, Kim Hoover Moore describes what it was like sitting through the testimony.
It was very hard to listen to. At times, I felt like I had to zone out because it was too much for me. For anyone to think that I could hurt anyone, I've never hurt anyone in my life. And for someone to make the accusation that I could hurt a child, it takes away from who you are.
So, Doctor, you were not involved in that case. It took place 2 decades ago when medical science viewed such cases differently than they do now. But there are questions here, whether abuse occurred and when the abuse occurred. How can you determine if it's an old injury and when it occurred, whether it's actually abuse?
It really depends on the case. Mm-hmm. There are some cases where, children may languish for a period of time and then become more symptomatic. And there are cases where they're almost immediately symptomatic. It's really difficult to just state on a blanket statement when there are a lot of other factors that are considered in that.
Yeah, these are weighty cases. I mean, it's not something that's lost on me. Whenever you make a diagnosis like this, this is weighty. Can you talk about that? I mean, you obviously chose to become an abuse pediatrician. So what was it? Why did you decide that you were going to take this path?
It was an area that was very interesting to me. Being able to kind of walk that line between the legal and the medical side. I love to educate, and that is a lot of what I do. I educate other physicians. I educate families. I educate juries and judges. And that is very enjoyable. I get to do that all the time. I also don't have the same day twice, unlike many of my colleagues who will see a lot of clinic and do the same thing every day. I have a variety. I don't just see abusive head trauma cases. I see children who are injured in other ways with broken bones. I see a lot of children who are neglected. We have a foster care clinic, so we see a lot of children there. We also see children who with suspected sexual abuse. We've been involved more with trafficking. So there's a variety of things I get to do, and I really enjoy that. I'm probably somebody that people see on their worst day, but hopefully I can make it better and help those families.
Have you testified in court on both sides of saying that this is abuse, the head trauma is from abuse, and saying, no, this is not abuse, and explaining why it's not?
I have not testified on the other side of an abusive head trauma case, but definitely on a physical abuse case, saying it was not abuse. Hmm. I have testified on the defense for other reasons for abusive head trauma. And then I do a lot of defense reviews. So I review a case, and then again, that's me providing the education to the attorney as to what the medical reasons are behind it and why the diagnosis was made or why it wasn't made in those cases.
So we talked about there are about 40 cases of exonerations where someone who was convicted of abuse, and especially back when it was called shaken baby syndrome, and they were exonerated. But to be clear, I mean, There are cases of abuse. Parents and child caregivers are not perfect. How many cases of abusive head trauma? Do you know how many there's been in the U.S.?
So the statistics show us it's probably around 1,500 kids every year that are injured in this way. That may only be the tip of the iceberg. It's hard to get those statistics and figure it out.
In the Nick Flannery case, as well as in the Kim Hoover case, there were medical professionals who gave conflicting testimony. How could there be two interpretations of the same CT scan?
I think it really goes back to the difference between our medical system and our legal system. Our legal system is designed to be adversarial. Everybody has a right to a defense, and part of that defense involves finding an expert who will testify for them. And so sometimes it's just you have to find somebody, and you may find somebody who will say that. That's probably one of the biggest things I see in those cases.
Have you testified on the side where you're saying this is head trauma, and then you've sat there in the courtroom and listened to another doctor completely contradict you?
I have done that, and far too often it's somebody who does not have my expertise and frequently not even a pediatrician, so somebody who doesn't really know children.
Some judges have started to look at the diagnosis with more skepticism. How does that impact your work?
I welcome the questions. I welcome somebody saying, "How did you do this and why did you do this?" Definitely. I like to be challenged. My colleagues and I continue to challenge each other, making sure that we're doing this right. I do worry that sometimes these professionals don't have the medical understanding, and so they really need to be open to getting that expertise and that education rather than just taking it without understanding the medical.
Now, I'm a mom. I've had infants. You worry about doing the wrong thing with the baby, right? Everyone tells you to protect the head, and it's so delicate. What words would you have for parents listening right now, who are just so worried that they're going to break their baby's head?
I will tell you, kids are pretty darn tough. We have kids routinely come into the emergency room after rolling off a changing table or a bed and hitting their head, and they do great. So kids are pretty tough. There's nothing wrong with protecting your kid's head, though. So I would say that's probably a pretty normal parenting thing to be worried, to feel guilty. We've all done it.
And the case here, the case that the ProPublica piece was about, Nick Flannery's case, their experts that they hired say that it's related to a birth injury, and that it just became an issue to need to go to the ER 2 months later. Have you seen cases like that where it can be a long-term thing instead of it being one quick incident?
I think that's a hard question to answer without having all the details there. And I really don't want to opine on a case that I'm not involved in.
Okay, yeah, that's fine. So you mentioned that, babies' heads are resilient and that parents need to be careful. Would you have any other advice for parents who hear cases like this about abusive head trauma, or still think of it as shaken baby syndrome? Would you have anything else that you wanted to say about what to worry about and what not to worry about, or to not be afraid to go to the hospital, I guess, is what I'm saying. Because I, if my baby fell off the changing table, I would, after ha doing this show, I would be worried about going to the hospital.
Like I said, I would not worry about going to the hospital. We see these kids all the time, and I'm not even called on those cases because the ED understands that that happens. Accidents happen. We see accidents. We know accidents well. So I would not be worried about going to the emergency room.
Okay. So, and what you're talking about is you're seeing things way more serious than an obvious accident.
Correct.
That was Dr. Susan Hanning, a child abuse pediatrician in Omaha and a member of the American Academy of Pediatrics. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
And coming up, we're going to talk with a lawyer who has handled abusive head trauma cases and written a book about it. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
We could all use a little help navigating the news these days. The Consider This podcast wants to give you a hand. 6 days a week, we'll help you make sense of the day's biggest news story and what it means for you in less than 15 minutes. Listen now to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. We're talking this hour about abusive head trauma and two Ohio cases that illustrate the medical and legal complexities involved in the diagnosis. In one case, Columbus child care provider Kim Hoover was wrongfully convicted of shaken baby syndrome in 2003 and spent nearly two decades in prison for murder. She was exonerated last year after medical records showed it was an old brain injury. More recently, a man on death row in Texas convicted of shaken baby syndrome had his execution delayed. Arizona attorney Randy Papity wrote a book in 2018 called The Forensic Unreliability of Shaken Baby Syndrome, and he joins us now. Welcome to All Sides, Randy.
Thank you.
So the case in Texas involves Robert Robertson, who was scheduled to be executed last October, but a group of lawmakers intervened. The judge halted the execution. He remains on death row for the murder of his two-year-old daughter, Nikki. He was sent to prison he was the first person to be put on death row for shaken baby syndrome, the first one to be sent to execution. But his case raises legal questions about the diagnosis. Why is the legal system growing more skeptical of these cases?
That's a great question. The science surrounding the diagnosis has been increasingly challenged over the past couple of decades. It's taken quite a while for the courts to start catching up. Courts are not usually the place where, you know, medical and scientific controversies get resolved or battled even. But the law is starting to catch up to the scientific challenges.
What led you to write a book about this topic?
This isn't my general field. I'm not a criminal defense lawyer. Mm-hmm. I'm not a family law lawyer. On a case in the late 90s, which involved a man who had been sentenced to 35 years for allegedly murdering his fiance's daughter. And the more I dug into the science behind the diagnosis, the conviction was based almost entirely on the diagnosis. It just became clear that there wasn't a scientific basis for it. And I thought it would unravel over time, but these cases keep getting filed, and I kept trying to help on these cases. And I thought maybe if someone put together a sort of a comprehensive text about the history of the diagnosis and all the various issues, it might attract some attention, especially ultimately in the courts.
I want to bring into the conversation now Ken Otterberg, a researcher at the National Registry of Exonerations. The registry is a project of the University of California, Irvine, the University of Michigan Law School, and Michigan State University College of Law. Researchers collect, analyze, and disseminate information about all of the known exonerations of innocent criminal defendants in the U.S. from 1989 to present, which is more than 3,600 exonerations. So welcome to All Sides, Ken.
Thank you.
So included in that total, that number I just said, are 40 exonerations where a pre-conviction diagnosis of shaken baby syndrome or abusive head trauma. Can you tell us about the Kim Hoover Moore case here in Columbus? It happened 23 years ago, so it was called shaken baby syndrome then, but she was recently exonerated. What happened there?
So Ms. Hoover Moore's case is I hate to say fairly typical, but it's a fairly typical case about the shaken baby diagnosis. She ran a daycare. There was a child in her custody, in her care, who became sick. She took her to the hospital, and she was prosecuted under the theory that she was the last adult with this child before she was brought to the ER. At trial, the state presented what they call the triad of symptoms that were associated with shaken baby syndrome, which is retinal hemorrhaging, brain bleeds, and other hemorrhaging, and she was convicted. There was some other testimony that she had occasionally roughed up some other children in her care at the daycare. Mm-hmm. And then eventually, you know, she sat in prison for a long time while the science caught up to what had actually happened in her case, which was that the injuries to this child happened well before she was with Ms. Hoover Moore on the day that she was brought to the emergency room, which is somewhat typical that there's a greater understanding of child injuries, how they happen, and what things are often masked by these quick diagnoses of shaken baby syndrome.
And Randy, there's a British pediatrician neurosurgeon who's widely credited with first connecting the symptoms of shaking a baby. This is a paper that dates back to 1971. But then he later disavowed his hypothesis that he had used. It relates to those three symptoms that Ken just mentioned that are like typical in a baby whose head has been shaken. But he told NPR in 2011 that there's no way to say that those symptoms are always caused by shaking and not caused by anything else. Randy, what do you make of him walking back his original hypothesis?
I tell you, Amy, crazy thing. When he was very late in life, he retired for a time in Tucson, Arizona, from Great Britain, and went to Tucson. And one of the cases I had, we asked him to review it. The team I had asked him to review it. He was appalled that his research had been used to convict someone in that kind of case. He actually gave a sworn testimony to help get an exoneration in that case. He spent a good chunk of his late years of life trying to clarify that his research had been distorted, that he was simply trying to raise concern about the potential dangers of shaking a child, not to create some forensic construct to be used to infer shaking or to infer abuse. So he was sometimes thought as the father of shaken baby syndrome, yet those still advocating it sort of view him as, almost an afterthought.
Randy, what do you make of the name change from shaken baby syndrome to abusive head trauma?
Well, I believe it was principally tactical. By 2009, the shaken baby syndrome had become a controversial topic. They used to say that you can infer abuse because we know we can infer shaking, and so we know there was abuse. Now they just say we can infer abuse. So the week before the last Roberson stay of his execution, the Texas Criminal Court of Appeals recognized, first court I've seen that recognized, that the name change was to vague up. That was their term, vague up.
Vague
Vague
up.
up. To vague the diagnosis. I think vague the diagnosis. So it's very hard to defend a diagnosis of abuse. It's not connected biomechanically. It's not connected anatomically. How do they know it's abuse if they can't tell it was shaking?
And Ken, in all of your work with exonerations and ones related to abusive head trauma or shaken baby syndrome, you mentioned earlier that eventually medical science catches up with the court. So are you seeing that more often? I'm sure you're seeing it in not just these cases, but other cases where the court made decisions and now just the medical science is better at understanding things and interpreting things. Are you seeing that more now?
There's lots of instances where the what was considered, gold standard forensic evidence has now been discredited. You can talk about microscopic hair analysis, you can talk about bite mark analysis, blood spatter, all sorts of things that were arson investigations that were seen as legitimate forensic evidence in trial has really come under greater scrutiny. Shaken baby syndrome testimony is perhaps, the one that has, been most challenging because the expert witnesses at trials were not just arson investigators or a technician or a dentist, but they were medical doctors. And so, before a jury, doctors are the, kind of the gold standard of expert witnesses. They are believed by jurors, and their testimony can be devastating to defendants.
We talked about the one case here in Columbus. Are there other cases from Ohio on the registry of exonerations related to this?
Yes, there's a the other case we have from Ohio is a woman named Donna Conley, who was exonerated in 2007 on a manslaughter charge for a case that involved a 4-year-old girl, her stepdaughter. This was not perhaps sort of a classic shaken baby case
A
in terms of
4-year-old's
like,
not quite a baby, yeah.
Yeah, when we have to, yeah, but there was some testimony that also got to this idea of the of subdural hematomas and the retinal hemorrhaging that essentially said that it couldn't have happened the way that Miss Conley said it had happened. You know, and again, that there's a, you know, when the police start investigating these cases, they often have an idea of what they want to do, and they take cues from the defendants about what had happened in the Roberson case that Randy talked about. One of the issues was that Mr. Roberson had this very flat affect when he was interviewed by the police, and they took that as a sign of his guilt when later it's been determined that, you know, he's on the autism spectrum, and that's just his way of processing information. It wasn't a sign of guilt or disinterest or lack of love. It was just who he is.
And Ken, have you seen not just Ohio, but have you seen the number of exonerations related to abusive head trauma grow whenever you're looking at the numbers?
You know, we add a couple of cases every year. They're difficult case. They become, Randy and I were talking about this before. You know, despite all the new science, they can be hard to get reversed because it requires a judge to say this is new evidence of innocence, as opposed to that would have made a difference at a trial, as opposed to it just the jury could have considered it and still disregarded it.
Randy, is there any other case that you highlighted in your book that you'd like to talk about that you think that our listeners should just know that, you know, shaken baby syndrome, abusive head trauma is not black and white. There's nuance.
Yeah, I mean, my book has a illustrative case in it. It's the illustrative case of Drayden Witt. Drayden's son was ill since birth, had been in the hospital for 5 days for unexplained seizures, finally unable to eat or hold food down for days, eventually collapsed, was taken to the hospital, and doctors said, "Oh, this must be shaken baby," because of the findings. Before the child died, the police were at the home, taking off the windows and rifling through the house looking for evidence of abuse. And he went to prison for a decade before we overturned his conviction. He was stabbed, though, 74 times while he was in prison as a baby killer by the Aryan Nation. So he carries that, including pieces of metal still in his body from that. He carries that despite the exoneration and with no compensation from the state. So for every exoneration, and Drayden is on the National Registry, but for every actual exoneration, there are many, 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 many multiples of these cases where folks either go through the process and have the claims dropped, or they're acquitted at trial, or they plead to some lesser crime of negligence or recklessness to avoid these results. There are several cases going on in Ohio right now where people have reached out to me looking for help. So there's a lot of nuance here, a lot of nuance, and I believe it's a completely collapsing construct, and this is going to end in institutional scandal sometime in the next decade.
And Ken, Randy mentioned, you know, the case that he just mentioned, there was he was exonerated, but he did not get any money from it. But does it vary state by state if you're exonerated, whether you get anything like to say that they're sorry?
Absolutely. The apology is a whole nother kettle of fish, but absolutely, you know, where you are convicted affects your chances of getting exonerated, and it also affects your ability to be compensated, you know, especially through state compensation.
Okay, and yeah, I believe the case that we highlighted from here in Columbus, she did receive some money. I can't,
Yeah.
yeah, I can't find that in my notes
Ohio
right now.
has better compensation laws than many states.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you for your time today. We've been talking about shaken baby syndrome, which is now known as abusive head trauma, and all of the nuances that come into that with all the complexities, the medical and legal complexities involved with that diagnosis. And I want to say thank you to Ken Otterberg of the Nash, a researcher with the National Registry of Exonerations. Thanks for being here, Ken.
You're welcome.
And thank you to attorney Randy Papadi, who wrote the book in 2018, The Forensic Unreliability of the Shaken Baby Syndrome. Thank you for being here, Randy.
Thank you.
And this has been All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich. Thanks for joining us.